I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Attorney-client privilege is considered a bedrock of America's legal system, but it isn't always guaranteed. In fact, KCUR has reported that over a two-year period, hundreds of calls from prisoners to lawyers were recorded by a contractor-run detention center in Leavenworth, Kansas. The case has gained national attention, and KCUR's Dan Margulies has been following it for nearly 2 years. Today we'll discuss its legal implications. Then we'll learn about the history surrounding Kansas City's Civil Rights Ordinance. In 1993, discrimination based on sexual orientation was barred in town. The move created a rift that's persisted for 25 years. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Attorney-client privilege is supposed to be one of the bedrock principles in America's legal system. The idea is clients should be able to talk to their attorneys confidentially about their cases. That way, the attorney can provide the best possible legal representation. The information provided to an attorney, meantime, can't be used in a court of law. It's supposed to be confidential. That apparently wasn't the case at the pretrial facility up in Leavenworth, where recordings of conversations between attorneys and their clients have shown up. KCUR's Dan Margulies has been reporting on this case for months. He broke the story, and he joins us now. Dan, it's always good to have you.
Always good to be here, Steve.
Dan is joined by attorney David Bell, who's with the Wersch, Hobbs, Merakian law firm in Kansas City. He once worked for the Missouri Public Defender System in Jackson County. David, welcome to you, too.
Thank you.
David, let's start with you. Explain the basics here just briefly. What is attorney-client privilege?
Sure. Attorney-client privilege is there to permit a client to be open and honest with the attorney. It really is an aspect that helps us build a relationship. We see in the courtroom kind of the Perry Mason moment and things like that, and that's fun and that's for movies and TVs. The reality is a majority of my job is spent getting to know my client and developing a relationship with my client, and it's because of that, I believe, in part, that the attorney-client privilege is so helpful to the work that I do in the criminal justice system.
So just in theory here, if a prosecutor is listening in on your conversation, the prosecutor who might be working on the same case, how would you feel about that?
Well, of course, I'd be horrifically upset. I'd be upset not only because that could provide the prosecutor with some type of strategy on my part, but even more so, the intrusion upon the relationship between myself and my client will wind up manifesting itself in negative ways throughout the process, not just strategy-wise, but just in terms of the client's ability to tell me things that he or she is embarrassed to talk about, is nervous to talk about. I have to develop a trust with this client, and now the client is thinking, well, geez, if I tell you, is someone else listening? And they're just going to shut down completely.
So, Dan, if that's the context here, what's been alleged in the case that you've been watching so closely now for so many months?
Right. So just to give you a little background, Steve, this all emerged nearly 2 years ago in August of 2016 in a contraband case that was being prosecuted against inmates of the Leavenworth pretrial detention facility and some of the guards as well as outsiders. And it was it was a big to-do made by the U.S. Attorney's Office when this indictment was unveiled. And that was the underlying case in which these allegations that attorney-client phone calls and meetings were being recorded, both audio and video recorded. That's the case in which these allegations first surfaced.
Now, why would a prosecutor audio tape and videotape anything
so
like this?
Let me make something clear, Steve. It's not the prosecutors that were recording these meetings and or phone calls.
But
it was the operator of the prison up in Leavenworth, a company that was then known as – well, is now known as Core Civic. And the – operator of the phone system there, a private contractor known as Securus. Now, they often record phone calls. That's not controversial in and of itself between inmates and other people as part of monitoring, you know, security, et cetera. But attorneys, phone calls between attorneys and their clients are supposed to be off limits. Now, all these calls, when an inmate makes a call at that facility, there's a pre-recorded message that says that this call might be recorded. But again, there was supposed to be a provision whereby attorneys let Securus and Corus Civic know that they were attorneys and that these are their phone numbers, and these phone numbers are not supposed to be recorded. And yet it emerges that many of them were recorded, either by dint of people up there not following the rules, deliberately flouting their own protocol, or else through incompetence and negligence. Now, the judge in the case was so upset about these revelations that she appointed a special master, a neutral third party, to look into this.
Mm-hmm.
And this special master, an attorney in Cleveland named David Cohen, has been issuing periodic reports in which he has uncovered that some hundreds of phone calls between attorneys and clients were recorded.
Hundreds of phone calls.
But now it turns out it may be even way, way more than that. So this whole scandal over recorded attorney phone calls has spawned any number of lawsuits by detainees who claim their rights were violated, who mm-hmm. claim that their convictions and or the charges that were brought against them should be thrown out. Now, one of the lawsuits, ancillary lawsuits that this whole mess has spawned, is a class action lawsuit brought by some attorneys who claim that their phone calls were impermissibly recorded. And in a motion they filed last week to have the case certified as a class action on behalf of all attorneys whose phone calls were impermissibly recorded, they revealed that their discovery has shown that at least 1,300 phone calls between the Federal Public Defender's Office and their clients over a two-year period between 2011 and 2013 were recorded. That's a bombshell.
How did prosecutors get a hold of these recordings? I mean, it's one thing to record them. It's something else than to turn these conversations, these tapes and videotapes, over to prosecutors.
Right. So it's not clear the extent to which prosecutors obtained access to these recordings. We know that in at least a handful of instances they did, because they have acknowledged as much. When I say prosecutors, I'm talking specifically about the U.S. Attorney's Office in Kansas, which is at the center of this whole burgeoning scandal. So we learned in the course of the original case that, yes, they had listened in on a couple of phone calls they claim inadvertently, and that as soon as they recognized that it was an attorney-client phone call, they stopped listening. But that's not entirely clear. You know, initially they denied categorically that they had listened in to such phone calls, but then they acknowledged that, oh yeah, there were a handful. So part of the special master's job, David Cohen's job, is to look into the extent to which the U.S. Attorney's Office may have listened into these phone calls. Now, the U.S. attorney stopped cooperating with him many months ago, and that was the subject of a hearing just a few weeks ago before mm-hmm. the judge, Judge Julie Robinson, who has been presiding over this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the federal public defender had sought to have the U.S. attorney's office held in contempt. And before that hearing ended, it was scheduled to last for 2 days. After the first day of testimony was given, the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Federal Public Defender announced in court that they were going to try to reach an agreement, both prospective and retrospective, on how to handle all this.
Has a resolution been announced?
No resolution has been announced. And I think this latest revelation that I'm talking about, these 1,300 phone calls, may complicate the matter.
David Bell, have you ever heard of anything like this before? How unusual of a situation is what Dan's describing here?
Well, it's highly unusual, and I have never heard of the situation. You know, when you go into a facility, and I've been to a number of facilities, state and federal, and this is CCA in Leavenworth we're talking about, there is a intercom system there. The belief is that you're not being listened to. Mm-hmm. That is the assumption you're going into and the assumption that the client's having. When you're on the phone, even though it's an attorney-client privilege, I always announce that in the beginning just in case someone is listening. But even on the phone, I'm still hesitant to talk in fear of someone potentially listening in. And so I will tell you, I've never heard of it before until this case. And while I'm not completely shocked by it, it is extremely disturbing.
I mean, what would your concern be? I still want to wrap my arms around this, David. Someone might be listening in. That's one thing, some prison employee. But again, we're talking about a situation here where potentially not only did someone listen, but then took the information to the prosecutor involved in the case and gave them that information. That's a two-step fandango here, isn't it?
Sure, and absolutely. Well, first of all, there's underlying issues here that bother me. First of all, is the socioeconomic aspect of it, because the only inmates you're going to have at CCA are going to be essentially pretrial inmates that don't have the means in some cases, although the federal system is a little different, to get out. All right, or for some, they don't have status in the country, so they're going to be held in custody. So their access to attorneys is going to be limited anyway, because it takes me an hour to get out there. I have to pre-schedule it. I have to go through a metal detector. I have to register to have my computer come in. I can't bring a phone in. It's a major pain in the rear, frankly, to go out in any event.
Right.
So now you go out, and now either by phone call you don't feel comfortable talking, or even in the relationship in the off in the detention area, you don't feel comfortable, and so it completely guts any attempt that you could have potentially at the relationship. It's not so much, by the way, that the prosecutor is going to listen in on strategy or things like that. It's the fact that you and I, if you're the client, know that someone may be listening, that you as the client and me as the attorney are not going to be able to have as honest and open a conversation as we otherwise would. And again, the process we're talking about in the criminal justice system requires me as the attorney to get to know you as the client, to get to know how you got to this point, in addition to getting to know your take on this case so that I can present you in court at trial, or more likely, I can present your case to a prosecutor for a disposition without trial.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about the importance of attorney-client privilege and whether that was violated in a series of instances up at the pretrial facility up in Leavenworth here. You know, you think something like this would be unprecedented. David, you've alluded to that. Then I just heard about another similar case out of Moniteau County, if I'm saying that right, Missouri, just west of Jeff City. What do we know about that case? Do you know much about it, David?
I heard briefly about that case the other day, that it involves the same allegations, if you will, with regard to, I think, intrusion upon the attorney-client privilege. I forgot if it was visits or if it was telephone calls.
I don't know about this case.
I think the ultimate issue in that case, by the way, will be something to the effect of what is the relief that is going to be sought. And here's where another problem is going to come in. You've identified a wrong, Steve, and the wrong is intrusion upon the attorney-client relationship. Well, what's your relief? In the criminal case, one issue is whether or not that intrusion prejudiced the defense or prejudiced some aspect of it. The way the law is moving in terms of suppression of evidence and suppression of statements, the courts like to extract the evidence or the statement that was wrongfully obtained, but allow the case to go forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and how also—
As opposed to dismissing it outright.
As opposed to dismissing it outright. And what we're dealing with in that case would be what would be considered a structural error, where you don't necessarily have to prove prejudice to the case itself, but you're able to look back and say, you know, as to this case, we don't trust the process to produce the right result, whatever that may be.
Mm-hmm.
That's a structural defect, and that would result in a dismissal of a case. I will tell you, based on what I know, it's horrifically difficult to get a case dismissed based on what would be considered a structural defect.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm concerned there will not be any relief in the criminal cases here because of that.
Is there talk about cases being dismissed outright, or is David's point here sort of in play and you don't expect that to happen, Dan?
Well, there are dozens of lawsuits, as I alluded to before, that have been filed by detainees in Leavenworth claiming that their calls having been recorded, their calls with their attorneys having been recorded, their cases should be thrown out, their convictions if they were convicted, their pleas if there were such, because, as David alludes, they unfairly prejudiced the outcome in the case. Now, you know, merely the fact that the calls have been recorded doesn't say anything about whether prosecutors had used them. But it certainly creates a rebuttable presumption that their case may have been unfairly tarnished
mm-hmm.
by the use of such phone calls. So as I say, this stain of this scandal, if you want to call it that, has really spread far and wide, because we're not only talking about defendants in Kansas, but that facility up there in Leavenworth holds pretrial defendants from a large geographical area, including Missouri. So we're seeing all kinds of lawsuits being filed as a result of these revelations.
Is it possible
to have these cases thrown out?
Is it possible there could be lawsuits that stem from cases settled even before the last couple of years, because who knows how long this practice has been in play?
Oh, absolutely. And that is what we're seeing now in connection with the latest, what I regard as a bombshell revelation, namely the 1,300 phone calls from the of attorneys from the Federal Public Defender's Office alone that have been recorded in a two-year period between 2011 and 2013, you know, many, many years ago. So who knows how far back this goes? So one of the things that is remains up in the air is not only the prospective relief that the U.S. attorney might agree to, namely that we're going to make sure that we never listen in on recorded attorney phone calls if somehow we have access to them. But the more difficult question is now how to deal with all those cases in the past.
And working with what Dan's saying, you know, let's say a situation, the phone call between myself and the client says the gun is under the car. The government then goes and gets the gun and admits it into evidence at trial, and my client's convicted. It's clear what the prejudice was in that case.
Mm-hmm.
That case, I doubt, will meet any fact pattern we're going to see from any of these calls. And so it will be less clear as to what the specific prejudice was to the case itself. And without that prejudice, my concern is there will be no relief, because the system at this point is not looking to punish the government, either law enforcement or prosecutors, for misconduct in terms of allowing what society considers the guilty to go free.
But what does the facility itself, Dan, say about what's happened here? Do they acknowledge these recordings were made, or where are we with that?
Well, they have not been willing to speak to me. They keep saying that they don't comment on matters in litigation. But what has emerged in court proceedings is, you know, they readily acknowledge that they monitor phone calls, which all prison facilities do around the country for security purposes, and record a lot of phone calls and make it clear in the detainee's handbook that each inmate is supposed to get when they arrive there and they're processed, that their calls may be monitored and recorded. But again, I emphasize that that same handbook says that attorney-client phone calls and meetings, there are special meeting rooms where attorneys meet with their clients, are supposed to be off limits.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't really said much about why those things may have been recorded. And or they say they're monitored. Initially, they said they weren't recorded. They're monitored in the meeting rooms to make sure that, you know, the attorney is safe. But as to why they were recorded, which emerged later in the proceedings, they haven't really given any explanation for that.
David Bell, to what extent is this case the subject of national news within the legal community and legal publications? Are we seeing stories being written out of Leavenworth, Kansas?
Well, in terms of the legal community that I'm seeing locally and somewhat nationally, it's big news. And the reason it's big news is because you would rarely have this type of proof. If these were allegations being made and there was no recordings to back it up or no admissions by the government, it would essentially dissipate and go away. The fact that you have evidence and the fact that the attorney-client privilege ultimately, regardless of the Fourth Amendment becoming a historical relic, the Fifth Amendment and parts of the Sixth kind of becoming historical relics under the current kind of legal system, the one sacrosanct aspect of our justice system is the attorney-client relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the third rail as far as I'm concerned. And that's why I'm here to talk, by the way, when you asked me to be here. That's why I'm here, because that's the one thing that I've got with my client that you, Steve, can't touch and Dan can't touch and a court can't touch and a prosecutor can't touch. And in this case, it has been touched. And to me, that goes to the fundamental kind of a foundational aspect of our system, and it's very concerning that it happened at all.
You know, the other thing that confuses me about this case, Dan Margulies, is this notion that there seems to be, based on the stories you've written, a lot of tension between the prosecutor and the public defender's office. You know, on one level, you might think there'd be a level of contrition here, but there's tension and deadlines not being met. What's that about?
Well, that is a great question, Steve. I will say that there is a new U.S. attorney now in charge of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Kansas. His name is Stephen McAllister. He's a former dean of KU Law School. He was the Solicitor General for the state of Kansas. And I think he recognizes that there has been a big problem in terms of the relationship between the Federal Public Defender's Office, which, of course, represents a lot of indigent defendants in the state, and his office. And he's trying, I think, to rectify that, and he's coming at it from a position of good faith. But I think there's inherently a lot of tension in the relationship between prosecutors and public defenders, because they are, you know, at loggerheads in terms of what they're each trying to do.
But I want to just point out, right, at one point, the federal public defender subpoenaed more than a dozen current, yes, and former employees of the U.S. Attorney's Office to testify about all this. I mean, that's ratcheting things up quite a bit,
isn't
it?
That was the hearing I was referring to that took place a few weeks ago that was interrupted midway through when the two sides said that they were going to try to reach an agreement. But the federal public defender took this rather radical step, rather unprecedented step, subpoenaing prosecutors from the U.S. Attorney's Office after the U.S. Attorney's Office, as I said, stopped cooperating with the special master. And the federal public defender was seeking to hold that office in contempt, an amazing thing. So they, you know, subpoenaed various prosecutors to testify about how much they knew about the recordings being made up at Leavenworth and to what extent they may have made use of them.
Well, why would the prosecutor stop cooperating with this, in theory, neutral special master in the case?
That is a very good question. And they sent him a 20-page letter some months ago in the fall claiming that he was overstepping his bounds, that he was going far beyond his jurisdiction, that he was treading on internal matters that were not a matter of, you know, that shouldn't be a public matter, and that they weren't going to cooperate anymore as a result.
David, from your standpoint, what needs to happen now to begin to repair the damage that appears to have been done here?
Sure. I think, first of all, I know individuals. I worked with individuals at the office, U.S. Attorney's Office of Kansas, and there's some really fine individuals there. There are some that maybe aren't, but that's the same in any office and, frankly, in any profession.
Sure.
I think ultimately that the cooler heads will prevail, and I'm hoping that they will get together and resolve an agreement. What needs to happen is that CCA, and they're private, by the way, private company.
The contractor that runs the facility.
Right.
Yeah.
They need to be very open about what is happening, and they need to follow through with that. There needs to be some check on that. There needs to be a phone line or some type of method of communication that cannot be listened into without a warrant, for example, in the prison or in the jail system.
And attorneys need to be assured that that, in fact, is the case, that no one's listening.
Correct. And there needs to be some, I believe, some teeth to that and some punishment if it's not being met. I think that's the first part with regard to the phone. With regard to the visits, the same thing needs to be met with the terms of, and you go there and you'll see in some cases two or three what looks like intercom systems. There's a camera up there. I'm not as concerned, frankly, of the camera because I don't know what it would even show. That being said, I want some assurance. I want the CEO, for example, of CCA, who's making money off of the prison system, to come in and sign, or on someone on his or her behalf to come in and say, listen, we are complying with these specific rules so that everyone has the same expectations and we can conform our conduct to,
yeah,
those expectations. Right now, I don't know. And so if someone calls from the prison, and by the way, I think a lot of times that I know these inmates are paying. So they were paying probably for the right through Securus to have their conversation monitored, which makes it even worse, frankly. That being said, if we have them come in and the U.S. Marshals Service, who I believe is in charge of the prisons, comes in and the court and the public defender and the U.S. attorney all come together and say, these are the rules of the road and we're all going to have buy-in here, then I'll trust that. And we'll move forward at that point.
Dan, what do you expect, just to wrap up our conversation here, what do you expect the next steps to be here?
Well, I just want to point out one thing before I answer that question, and that is that CoreCivic CCA, the company that runs this facility in Leavenworth on contract with the U.S. Marshals Office, runs hundreds of prisons and jails throughout the country. It is a huge multi-billion-dollar corporation. So to the extent that what's happening in Leavenworth may be happening at its other prison facilities and jails across the country, this is a matter of huge concern that goes beyond just Leavenworth.
Wouldn't that be something?
Right.
Yeah.
So what I expect to happen next, Steve, in answer to your question, is I expect the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Federal Public Defender to reach an agreement about how to handle this matter going forward. Now, what as I said, is going to be more difficult to resolve is how to handle all these past cases in which conversations may have been recorded. I think they're going to try to reach a resolution about that, but whether they can is hard to say.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Interesting, interesting case. I want to thank Dan Margulies, who's been following this case so closely for KCUR for so many months. David Bell with the Wersch Hobbs Merakian Law Firm. Great to have you both. Let's keep talking about this, okay?
You bet.
Thank you.
Okay, time for a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about one of the most controversial steps in Kansas City history, and in addition to the locals' rights ordinance back about 25 years ago. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we sat down with two of Representative Kevin Yoder's six Democratic challengers this spring. We discussed gun reform, school funding, and the impact of President Trump's trade war on Kansas farmers. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we learn how the University of Missouri and its administrators are planning to increase enrollment, which dipped after on-campus racist incidents back in 2015, and the responding protests that made national news. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, 25 years ago, at the height of the AIDS crisis, the City Council of Kansas City took one of the most controversial steps in city history. It added sexual orientation to the local civil rights ordinance, barring discrimination against lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and people with HIV/AIDS. This was the culmination of a three-year fight, and it resulted in a rift still felt today in Kansas City. With us to talk about this battle for equal rights are John Barnett. He was an activist involved in the push for this ordinance. John, nice to have you. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. Thanks.
Austin Williams is a filmmaker who has made a documentary about this moment. It's called The Ordinance Project, about the lead up to and passage of this revised ordinance in 1993. Austin, welcome to you.
Steve, thanks for having me.
Well, what spurred the push for this ordinance 25 years ago, John? What was happening back then?
Wow.
So much.
Yeah. What, I guess there's a lot of things going on, but probably the biggest one was the AIDS epidemic.
Mm-hmm. And what spurred the city council to take this monumental step when it did?
They were spurred by a group of people who were making their lives pretty miserable for not doing something. Mm-hmm. And that was an organization called ACT UP, which I was the founder of.
Mm-hmm. Who were some of the key members of the council at the time who were open and receptive to hearing your argument?
You really determined to test my memory on things. There was Catherine Shields, obviously.
Who's still on the council today.
Dan Coffrin. Bobby Hernandez wasn't an ally or an opponent particularly. And why am I blanking on...
There were others, too.
There certainly were. Right. There was a key one.
Two city councils, too, because it's overlap between those. And I do know
Frank Palermo.
Ah, okay.
Frank Palermo
actually
brought – he chaired the committee that David Weed and I presented the idea of passing – adding sexual orientation and HIV status to the existing human rights ordinance in the city.
How big a moment was that, John?
Oh, my God. It's a very – prominent in my memory because I don't even know if I'd really been in City Hall, or at least not that much before. And here we are in a room with the committee members, and David and I had worked up a paper proposal, and we were making our presentation to a group of council members, and it was a totally new experience for me.
Austin, I compared to other cities, how early was Kansas City in extending this kind of protection to members of the LGBT community?
You would actually probably say that when it comes to like the second tier cities, especially, that Kansas City is actually fitting into that window in the late 80s and early 90s when you start seeing a whole proliferation of these ordinances. They really start kind of coming into existence around the late 70s, and then you see the pushback with Anita Bryant and the Save Our Children campaign. Throughout the 80s, the larger cities like New York City, Chicago, but Chicago was only about a year ahead of Kansas City in pushing for this ordinance. What was really unique about Kansas City, and I'm still looking for another city that tried this two birds with one stone approach was that in 1990, the ordinance that was proposed actually was doing three things at once. It was going to add familial status.
In Kansas City, we're talking about.
In Kansas City, yeah. Right, yes. So that you couldn't discriminate against people in housing for having children. It was also then going to make HIV an official handicap status. And then it was going to add the word sexual orientation to the existing civil rights ordinance. And no one really had a problem with the familial status portion. Many people had an issue with the HIV/AIDS portion, but it was clearly the sexual orientation addition to the civil rights ordinance that that people came out in essentially record numbers. There were over 3 weeks worth of testimony, letters, phone calls, and that initial ordinance that was introduced in 1990. Actually was sent back to committee and, in essence, was killed.
You know, people need to remember correctly, in the early 90s, HIV/AIDS was a really scary proposition. This was a whole different time, a whole different climate when it came to trying to deal and confront these kinds of issues, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think John alluded to earlier, I mean, to kind of set some of the context as to what's going on throughout the 1980s, a lot of people that I've spoken with kind of refer to this a high point in activism that's occurring in Kansas City as far as LGBT activism in the late 70s, the early 1980s, but with the onset of this disease that was referred to as GRID, gay-related immune deficiency, eventually becomes known as AIDS. There is kind of this, and John, correct me if I'm wrong here, but like in the mid-80s, there wasn't nearly the activism that maybe had been occurring in the late 70s until around 1987, that March on Washington. Someone tonight at the Kansas City Public Library, Kay Madden, is going to be there to talk about that march inspired a lot of people to form organizations here like the Pink Triangle Political Coalition. And then I know it was in the summer of 1988 that I do love the story, John, about you co-founded ACT UP KC. And I believe it was in it was spawned by the Circle K Corporation, right? What happened there?
That was an employee who had lost his coverage for health insurance because of, based on his HIV status. Circle K Corporation stated that they had a policy that they would not cover lifestyle illnesses.
Right.
So, and they counted HIV and AIDS as that. You need to go back to 81 when the first mention of this mysterious ailment was published by in the mortality report from the CDC, and it took time even after that before it became news in the gay community, and it really wasn't news to the general public. So about the time that David and I, we started the work of changing the ordinance here in Kansas City, somewhere in that several years, 8, 9, 10 years, people were dying in my community. I lost a majority of my friends and loved ones in the gay community, but the rest of the community wasn't that affected by it, other than those people who might have had a child or a loved one who was affected. So within the gay community, though, this was I have trouble coming up with words that aren't going to sound dismissive because they're too superlative, like the nuclear bomb, of devastation in this community. And it drove people out of the closet that might not otherwise have needed to do that.
And again, I'm trying to just set the stage for how difficult all this was. Last weekend was Pride in Kansas City, but in 91, then mayor and our current congressman, Emanuel Cleaver, he refused to sign a proclamation at that time, noting Gay Pride Week. He said it would divide the city. So that was in 91, John. And then in 93, the city council passed this ordinance. What changed at City Hall?
So many things. I when I try to remember back 25 years ago, it's not real easy to do. That a lot of what we were doing may have seemed political, and it was, but it was a vehicle to change hearts, minds, and souls. And this was a process of doing that. The ordinance was important, but what was more important was the process we went through in Kansas City. All of those hearings were televised through the cable system. people saw gay and lesbian people for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Emmanuel Cleaver, Reverend Emmanuel Cleaver, bless his heart. I mean, he and I have had our moments of confrontation,
mm-hmm.
and yet I have nothing but the greatest respect for the man today because he evolved. He mm-hmm. came out of a community and a culture where supporting people for being gay was just not easy to do. You know, and he chose – he could have gone either way with that proclamation. And he went – what he did was not the right choice, and he has more than made up for that subsequently.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about a monumental moment 25 years ago when sexual orientation was added to the local civil rights ordinance in town, a breakthrough moment for the LGBT community. Austin, you mentioned earlier that Kansas City was probably early among the mid-tier cities for adopting laws like this. What made you want to come out and document all this through the film you've just made?
Actually, the man sitting to my left right now. I mean, it's a long story, as most stories are, but I'm a doctoral candidate and adjunct professor at UMKC. And
yeah.
It was during a class that was a graduate studies class on Kansas City activism that I asked one of my professors. We were supposed to interview a Kansas City activist, and I said, "Do you have anyone in mind? I don't really know anyone." And they said, "Well, we know this gentleman who was the first openly gay candidate for city council." And I went to John's house just based on that recommendation. And by the time I left, I don't want to say like, you know, I knew I was going to make a documentary, but I knew that he was just so open about a chapter of Kansas City history that I really felt almost ashamed having not known mm-hmm. as much about this as I should. And it was from there that John immediately, you know, said like, well, you need to talk to David Weida. You need to talk to Keith Spare. You need to talk to all these folks.
Uh-huh.
So then you start talking to some people. And then I have a background in videography. And I thought, well, if I'm going to interview people and get their stories for, you know, a paper or maybe a dissertation. I was still trying to figure out what this was. I was like, well, let's go ahead and, I mean, capture their oral histories so that other researchers can build upon it. And that's when I teamed up with the Gay and Lesbian Archive of Mid-America at UMKC and also the LGBT Film Festival to launch the Ordinance Project, which was a crowdfunding endeavor that helped us raise the money to get the video equipment and the travel funds to go visit these activists and politicians. And quite literally, over the last year, I've been as far as Bangor, Maine to Orange County, California. So, I mean, that's about as wide a spread, I think, in the U.S. as you get. And, I mean, and it's been really eye-opening. And one of the challenges, like even as we sit here today, is to just put into context how much was happening. And so one of the names I think we didn't mention earlier was Joanne Collins, as mm-hmm. far as one of the,
sure.
the early advocates
Absolutely.
On the city council. That as early as the late 70s and early 1980s, Kansas City politicians were considering an ordinance like this. But with such a nationwide pushback by people like Anita Bryant and the Save Our Children campaign, it wasn't considered the right timing. But throughout the 1980s, and John, you've said this before too, I like this, that you say there were many sparks that led to one fire. And there was something Mayor Richard Berkeley had put forth an AIDS council who also had the recommendation of taking on an anti-discrimination ordinance to protect people with HIV and AIDS at the same time that John and David, as members of ACT UP, are forming what was referred to as an affinity group of ACT UP that eventually right. became the Human Rights Ordinance Project. And then you have behind the scenes people like Keith Spare, who was a very close friend of Emmanuel Cleaver's, and
Linda May also.
Oh, Linda May
was tight with Cleaver.
Yeah.
Well, what was it like for you, John, living through that time? You know, just based on what Austin just said, this notion that it wasn't the right time yet. You had to wait and wait for the moment to come. That must have been so difficult.
I'm sitting here in awe. If it wasn't for Austin and this project of the documentary,
and
I wonder,
recounting all this history, yeah.
Yes. I mean, like Joanne Collins, how could I possibly not have that name popped to my mind at the very
right.
as one of the first. She was such a key ally. She was unwavering,
mm-hmm.
staunch supporter of this from day one until the end.
How was it? What was the frustration level like for you?
It was crazy. It was crazy. And that's what fed the anger. And it wasn't just me and a handful of people. There were, if you look back, and I'm hoping that people will see the documentary and see some of the clips from the news reports of hundreds and maybe thousands of people at demonstrations on the step of Kansas City Hall. Mm-hmm. What other events other than perhaps the civil rights movement of the 60s, have you seen that kind of public outcry? And look at some of the other ACT UP comments of the anger that, that all the for many of us and them, the point was to just piss people off. I hope that isn't a bleeping word there.
Austin, how tough was it for you to find archival footage of these moments to help pull your documentary together? And I should point out that the program on this landmark moment in Kansas City history will be at 6:30 this evening at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library. More information, kclibrary.org.
Yeah, as easy as it is for me to say, I left John's house and knew I'd be making a documentary. You know, it was this kind of evolution where the first thing I did was, at first I thought I was just going to write a story about ACT UP KC because, I mean, some of the things that they were doing. And when we talk about individuals like Mark Sweetland and Michael Pointer, there were specific cases they took on about people that had been this gentleman had been fired from a company named Telecheck specifically because he had HIV/AIDS. Mm-hmm. Another gentleman had been fired from Walmart based on the rumor, not even confirmed, just the rumor that he was gay. And I thought, okay, I need to learn more about this. And as I was researching all this, professors were asking me, so are you going to write about AIDS? Are you going to write about gay and lesbian civil rights? And I was like, I kind of want to write about both. I mean, they seem to, and John was always big about that. You can't talk about one without talking about the other. Mm-hmm. They went hand in hand. And when I learned about this ordinance, the newspapers referred to it as the most heated testimony in Kansas City history, and hundreds of people showed up, and people were, you know, talking about how the fate of Sodom and Gomorrah is going to befall Kansas City. And the first thing I did was went to City Hall and tried to figure out, okay, these were taped and put on the city government channel each night, you know. Then I learned to my dismay that nothing before the year 2000 had been archived. But somewhere I figured out there's got to be these tapes. And as I started meeting more people, many people went home that night if they testified and had VHS taped the city government channel. And I don't know why it didn't dawn on me at first, because it was months later, John, that I was like, hey, do you have any VHS tapes of this? And and not only did we find the original testimony, but demonstrations of ACT UP KC,
right.
Target City Hall, when you were referring to hundreds of people on the steps of City Hall. And that's when it was clear that, like, okay, we got to get this out to the public somehow.
If our listeners recall these seminal days in Kansas City history, our phone number here to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. I'm wondering to what extent, John, does LGBTQ discrimination still occur here despite the ordinance in Kansas City? I mean, what do you see as the next big legal fights, especially that you see the LGBTQ community taking up here as it moves ahead?
You know, Steve, I've been in retirement for quite a while, so I'm sort of an armchair activist these days. I have so many things going through my head right now. One is that when Austin's talking about VHS tapes, and I'm thinking today, young people my age today that I was then have the internet, and they have tools we didn't have. We had phone. We used phone trees. You know, we had answering machines. We had VHS recorders on our TV shows. We didn't live stream anything, and there's such a difference from then to
right.
now. One of the things that I see has changed is, I said earlier that we really want to change people's hearts, minds, and souls. Mm-hmm. You know, the law was important. Today, what I see in these issues, here's what I'm thinking. Something came out of this that wasn't necessarily good. You know, we got an ordinance. Great. We have some protection we didn't have before. That's wonderful. What we also have is a society and a culture and a world that is more divisive and divided than ever. That I'm kind of struck by that we
even
won
today
something
on these issues.
Yes, the pushback and the blowback has been so profound and so dramatic. We saw this during the ordinance debate that we would, you know, one day the council would be with us, the next day because of the right wing backlash, they would would collapse. And Austin's film documents this. We had an ordinance, and then it failed. We had it. We had this ordinance two or three times, and then the religious right came in and counterattacked and moved it back. And the politicians were just swaying in the wind back and forth. That was then. Today, every time we make a step forward, the Supreme Court ruling on marriage equality, but we're getting attacked with wedding cakes, you know?
Paula from Miriam on the Kansas side. Paula, good morning.
Good morning. I just wondered if she hadn't already been mentioned, if your guests knew about Dr. Sharon Lee.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Because, you know, I knew that she was one of the first doctors to start addressing and HIV/AIDS and treating patients as far back as the 80s.
And she's
right?
with the free clinic today. Right?
Yes, yeah. Yes. And actually many people have mentioned her specifically as one of the key people that were treating people early on.
Yeah. Thanks, Paul. Right. I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks.
You know, I can't help but notice that just last week, the unified government of Wyandotte County right. in Kansas City officially amended the city's existing non-discrimination ordinance to include protections in housing, employment, and public accommodations on the basis of sexual orientation. So is that the same ordinance just, 25 years later that you all adopted back in 93?
I think it's the same type of protection, local protection for discrimination based on sexual orientation, yes.
And your reaction to that would be what?
That the more things change, the more they stay the same. I don't know. I don't think you're going to see the kind of reaction and negative blowback today that we did 25 years ago.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be much easier for cities to get those categories in their ordinances.
Just quickly, in the time we have left, John, the transgender people weren't included in protection sought 25 years ago, yes. And I'm wondering why not.
Wow. The hardest part, one of the hardest things about this process, because we had transgendered people working with us to get this passed. And my recollection, and I think you'll have different people have different recollections of this, that the ones that were working with us said they would support us moving forward without their inclusion that on the condition that we were going to work to get that added later.
Because it was too controversial?
It was too controversial. It was, you know, I think Catherine Shields' position on that was, you know, we're just barely getting to the point where we're going to get sexual orientation in there. Trans people at that time were even more scary to a lot of people than gays and lesbians. But I will say, I think we were wrong. I think we made a mistake not letting them insisting on that being included at the
again
time.
A program on this landmark moment in Kansas history tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Library. More info, kclibrary.org. I want to thank our good guests here, John Barnett, an activist back in those days, an armchair activist today, Austin Williams, a filmmaker, his new project, the Ordinance Project, that documents all this. Thank you both very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Tomorrow on the show, find out how vacant seats on the State Board of Education in Missouri have impacted local schools. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.